Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 25th day of April, and getting close here to the end of the first month of the second quarter, 4 months of the year moving by. And boy, is there a lot to talk about. Last week, we weren't really on the right side of what happened on Capitol Hill. Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, actually got it done. Got his bills passed. Didn't seem to lose his job. In fact, seemed to build support from across the aisle. We may now have a bipartisan functioning Washington that does business the way the Constitution describes that actually business would get done in Washington, that there would be serious debate, that there would be opposing sides and opposing opinions, and somehow they would meet in the middle to do the business of the American people. Whoever is responsible in Washington for getting any of that done, God bless you and keep you and make his face to shine upon you, because we need you there looking out for the American people. There's number one. Number two, markets have pulled back for 3 weeks, had a little bit of a rally, You would expect that. And now you want to see if the rally holds. And as of this morning, it looks like we're going to test that downside and take another down leg. Whether we actually test the lows or not remains to be seen. But the notion that the Fed will be higher for longer seems with us. It seems to be sinking in. And a lot of the leadership, a lot of those magnificent seven that went to the moon seem to be coming back from the moon. How far will they fall? And you look at other companies, not recommendations, but some of these consumer stocks that are always seen as defensive also can keep an eye on healthcare. They're holding up. So the safety trade is on. Sort of, except when you look at the bond market this morning, yields are going up, bond prices are coming down, and the yield on the two-year treasury this morning is 4.93, almost 5% on the two-year treasury. 10-year, 4.65, so that gap is a tad narrower, actually, but the six-month bill, three-month bill, 5.4%. There is an alternative to waiting. You see, when rates were at 1% or below for those money market, people were more eager to buy. They weren't making any money. But now they're sitting there saying, wait a minute, I'm guaranteed to make my 5% if I sit here on my cash, or I can get into this volatile thing that seems to be going up and down. Some of these stocks, 10, 15% in a day. In the world of earnings, in the world of those big stocks, what you need to think about here is, one, pullbacks are normal. And if you've listened to Kenny Pulcari or Jim Murray or any of our old hands, Jack Baruggi, and we've been telling you for a long time, we've been expecting this because they happen. What do you do from here? When do you try and take advantage? For that, we go to our great friend, Kenny Pulcari, Case Capital Advisors, and the Chief Market Strategist at Slate Stone Wealth. Good morning, Kenny.
Michael, how are you? What a fantastic introduction that was. You hit every nail on the head.
Well, I read your note this morning, Kenny. I read the Pulcari note. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't read the Pulcari note, oh, look, Ron Barron's on Squawk Box. They give him almost a whole half an hour. The guy's been so damn wrong, it's not even funny. He's maybe one of the greatest salesmen who comes in his schlumpy sweaters. He's one of the best salesmen out there, and Squawk Box seems to buy it. I don't. Go ahead, Kenny. I'm sorry. And now I'm going to be thrown off of CNBC.
Wow. You're really in a way today. No, I think you were right. You hit every nail on the head. I think it's important for your listeners to understand the broader picture like that, and to also understand that, you know, guys like you and me are not necessarily panicking because the market is repricing based on all this data that we're seeing, whether it's Fed policy, whether it's concern over earnings, whether it's concern over inflation, whether it's concern about the presidential election, whether it's concern over conflict around the world. It's just a matter of creating the plan and sticking to the plan as long as the fundamentals certainly don't change that much.
Does this scare you at all that we're having this pullback? I mean, the Fed makes another comment, something else happens. This is what listeners are thinking about, right? The Capitol Hill's a little bit crazy. Something crazy happens in Israel. Could the bottom really fall out of this market?
Well, so listen, I'm not necessarily worried about conflict, right? Because the conflict creates short-term opportunities. But as you know, the geopolitical stuff doesn't really price stocks in the long term. Does it create short-term volatility and opportunity? Sure. I'd be more concerned about the bottom falling out if we suddenly see the language at the Fed turn decidedly different. At the moment, I'm not worried about it. I think this repricing in the market is actually healthy. You and I have talked about it. I think it got well ahead of itself when it created this false narrative of multiple rate cuts in 2024. And now I think it's really accepting the fact that we may not get any. And quite honestly, I don't think we need any.
Hey, and to be fair, the market created that false narrative, right? The Fed never created that false narrative. The markets created that false narrative.
That's right. But the Fed talks and then the market creates a new narrative based on what it's here. And it's like anything. People hear what they want to hear versus what's being said, right? Jay Powell never said that they were cutting rates multiple times in 24. He never said that. He said, you know, the feeling amongst the committee was they could see the potential to see lower rates in 2024, but never once did he come out and say, oh, by the way, we're cutting X amount of times. It was the market that then took that language and suddenly it was 6 and 7 rate cuts starting in March and going every meeting until the end of the year, which I thought and you thought was absolutely ridiculous, right?
Because absolutely ridiculous.
Doesn't suggest it. Now I think Jay Powell has made it very clear to the markets. Look, you people better back off that narrative. It's not happening. We are starting to see inflation tick up month over month. And while maybe 1 month didn't make a trend, and you could argue 2 months, maybe not a trend, but you get into 3 and 4 months on a month over month basis, and you start to see it making a trend. And that should just cause, you know, the people to push back a little bit and say, look, we're okay where we are. The market was kissing new highs. Rates are 5.25%, which are historically normal. There's nothing abnormal about this. It needs to readjust. And if that means the prices need to readjust, that's okay. This is where it comes down to knowing what you own, having a plan, talking to your advisor, and not being way, way out on the risk scale because you think you have this fear of missing out.
You know, I think maybe it was humility by the Fed, which I don't know if anybody has said that much before, but I really think it's there. Because when I talk with Pat Harker at the University of Delaware, I said, Pat, why can't you all just accept your own success? Why can't you say, hey, we might have gotten it right? Hey, maybe rates are exactly where they ought to be, and unemployment can still stay low, and the economy can still grow, and the trend for inflation is coming our way, so we're going to sit on our hands because maybe we got it right and quit saying we've got to jigger this thing around too quickly. Anyway, Kenny, we got to go here. Tell me what you think we should do about stocks. Where are opportunities? Are these Magnificent Seven? Is this run that's just been crazy, is it over with as rates stay higher? Are people going to start calculating those future cash flows, present values for those tech companies and say, wait a minute, if rates stay high for longer, maybe we need to readjust and the real value is lower?
Well, they might, and I think you're starting to see some of that, right? You can see it in some of the big names that's exactly what's happening. But I don't think the tech story or artificial intelligence, and that's very much in its infancy. And so this is where you have to kind of know what you own, know the biggest names in the field, know the ones you're comfortable with, and then be able to ride the wave and take advantage when there are repricings or dislocations. Now, you know, from a broader perspective, there are other opportunities in the market. Look at some of the other sectors that we now see broadening out, whether it's small caps, whether it's healthcare, whether it's financials, all the even utilities, by the way, which got killed last year on this kind of rising rate environment. Well, if rates don't go any higher from here, I actually think there's opportunity in utilities. They're not sexy. They're not all, you know, they're not running up and down 12 to 10% every other day. They're not doing that, but they will add stability to your portfolio and they'll certainly pay you, you know, 3.5-4% dividend. And so you'll get paid for owning them along the way and it'll add stability to your portfolio. But you and I both know staying in the game for the long term is exactly where you should be. Knowing what you own is the second thing you should do and not be way, way out on the risk scale.
So hard to tell people how satisfying it is to get rich slowly.
Right.
So hard to convince people that it's very satisfying to get rich slowly. It is not exciting. It is not exciting. But no. I promise, Kenny promises, if you stick with this, if you do it and take that long-term view, and you look up one day and you have a lot more money than you ever thought you'd have, you will not be unhappy. Promise, you won't be unhappy. And all of the other folks are sitting there going, but I should have bought this and I should have bought that. Tough. You still got your money, and that's all you really needed to do. Kenny Pokhari, Case Capital Advisors, Chief Market Strategist of Slatestone Wealth, my very good, still a month older friend. Love you, Kenny.
Happy birthday to you, by the way. I missed your birthday.
Crap, I thought we'd get out of here without that.
But happy birthday. So now you and I are exactly the same age, Michael.
Only on the big number. I've still, still got a month on me. Got a month. Gotta go. We're coming up with Mahaffey. Stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Ann Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, as he does every week, pretty much. Well, hell, I do it pretty much every week, except when Labenthal's here. Dan Mahaffey, vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation, also a fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency in Congress, but the biggie is he's the senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Michael.
Great to be with you. We've got a bunch to talk about this morning, Dan. This is, okay, first, and I'm going to give you both number one and two here first. First, we were wrong. That's number one. Number two, I'll tell you why. Number two, he's looking at me like he's very puzzled about that. Number two, the Pennsylvania primary, which I thought was a big yawn and nobody paying attention to, Nikki Haley got 150,000 votes. Nikki Haley got 150,000 votes. Her name was still on the ballot. And that's kind of got people a bit spooked on the Trump side of the world. Also, that Joe Biden's numbers in recent polls are going up and more Trump on TV in the courtroom is not good, apparently, for the president's campaign. So first, let's go back. Mike Johnson got his votes done. Mike Johnson kept his job. Mike Johnson seems like he might be more popular than ever. And within a week, we're suddenly back to governing in Washington in a bipartisan way. I don't think either of us expected that. And that's why I said we were wrong.
No, I think we were wrong in that sense that there wasn't a dramatic matter here. And I think back too, though, to members of Congress who have said, if there is a majority for something in the House to happen, it will happen. It just can take long if the leadership is not aligned. And finally, though, Mike Johnson, and we're now hearing the stories of visits from the intelligence community, really a masterful job, I think, from the White House in giving him room to maneuver. You notice Biden never really pressured or spoke directly about Johnson during this process, never blamed him for any of the problems. So I think he gave him the room to maneuver around those members of his caucus who were opposed to this. And then behind the scenes, we know very effective lobbying by the evangelical community and particularly Ukrainian evangelicals, explaining to the speaker just what morally was at stake in Ukraine. And that appeared to resonate with him as well. So we've seen that happen. And I think too, frankly, the election year appetite, other than those who, again, Marjorie Taylor Greene and the others who just want to be on television, there's no other appetite in the caucus to go through again what we saw after the defenestration of Kevin McCarthy, where they don't need to do that now. They want to get stuff done, and then they want to focus on the election.
So is this, are the big losers here the extreme right and the extreme left and that whole crowd of...
Sure. I think to echo back to previous weeks, it's a reminder to those 80 people in the House that there are another 350 who want to get blankety-blank done. And they have asserted themselves. Now, it took time, again, because it was really... Again, nothing can move in the House quickly without leadership. And it took Johnson seeing the light on the Ukraine matter to come around on that. So that's where we are. I think
are we declaring victory too early?
No, I'm not declaring victory or anything on this. I think it shows that we've gotten this done. I don't think it changes any of the underlying dynamics in the House. It doesn't change the polarization. If one thing, maybe it has introduced a modicum of trust again on some of the armed services and intelligence committees where you have those important national security discussions and roles. But other than TikTok, which we also saw go through, there's not much else they're united on.
I find this very encouraging, Dan. What do you think?
I think it's encouraging for U.S. leadership, even though it took 7 months to happen. I don't see it as a change to the tenor of how things get done in Washington. At least, if anything, it's a example of a step in the right direction. But most of these people are crawling the other direction.
Well, I'm gonna keep my perpetual optimism out there and say maybe this is the beginning of the sea change that most Americans in the middle, and I don't mean necessarily in the middle of the country, but maybe I do, have been waiting for.
No, I think it reflects, though, I'll get to that, where, you know, now that I'm around more of those Americans in the middle of the country, how does it play in Peoria, as it were? I think what you see with a lot of Americans, they understand these dangers around the world. They see what's going on, but no one is explaining to them the strategy or end game. And that plays very poorly with a public that is tired after engagements in Afghanistan and Iraq, where they saw no end and they saw no outcome for our blood and treasure. So again, explaining to the American people America's role in the world and how we're doing this differently, learning from other conflicts, is important too. And that's just a message that neither Democrats nor pro-Ukraine Republicans have gotten across very well.
Yep, I hear you there. Nikki Haley got 150,000 votes in Pennsylvania. I mean, part of that, just again, all of this stuff just kind of warms my heart. Tell me if your heart is warmed or worried.
Look, I think it continues to reflect.
That was one of these great TV lines. Why couldn't I have come up with that on television, like live TV? Is your heart warmed or worried? That was a good one. Every so often, I listen to myself, ladies and gentlemen. You know where I catch
my. Heck, Michael, that sounds like something that's a debate type thing of, you know, are you better 4 years ago? Like, look at these two candidates. Which makes your heart warmed or worried?
Exactly. I'm worried.
That said, what do you see about this trend in Pennsylvania? Again, we've seen it. Nikki Haley continues to draw votes in an election she's no longer in. I get some concern about that among the Trump camp, but you can't guarantee that those are Biden votes. However, if they don't come to the Republican column come November, Trump does have a problem. But very equally, Biden is also looking at young voters, voters of color. He sees polls now where frankly, look, half of Americans are fed up with the point, and this is across parties, are fed up with illegal immigration to the point that they're starting to favor mass deportations. This is in the polling. So all of these suggest to both candidates that they have flaws, they have weaknesses ahead, and I'll continue to bang the same drum that it comes down to the double haters in this election who ultimately decide which one they're going to, frankly, stomach rather than enthusiastically vote for.
Right now, some are stomaching and some are enthusiastic as they see the president, former president, sit in a courtroom looking very unhappy in that courtroom. What's the effect of this trial? What's happening in New York? Does this have a lasting impact? Grumpy Trump.
New York trial seems to be the epitome of
there's another one. I could have that as the headline. That would be the headline article right there in the Wall Street Journal op-ed page today. Grumpy Trump. Sorry, Dan. I'm just
it's grumpy. He's out of control of the situation. He is the human equivalent, it seems, of a lion pacing too small of a circus cage. All of this does not look great from an image standpoint. I think, though, it just further boosts, again, his appeal among his base. The question is he appealing beyond his base? And we're not seeing too much evidence of that just yet. This trial, though, I think remains, though, the back burner one legally compared to the arguments that'll be before the Supreme Court today. But look, Trump's argument is so broad on presidential immunity. I felt that, you know, there's some confusion. You think that the justices have to weigh in on this, but my God, if Trump wins, then the next day Biden can just order an airstrike on Mar-a-Lago. I don't get the legal arguments here that we're going to see before the Supreme Court on presidential immunity. Those are going to, I think, have a greater emphasis on what this man thinks the office is and what his powers are and were.
Okay, so I've grown up listening to the line, no man is above the law. Is that codified somewhere, like the Constitution or anywhere else?
Well, look, the Supreme Court has a lot to weigh in on, and I don't think it's just going to be partisanship. Let's not forget that you have justices of both political backgrounds who have worked in the White House, who understand that there are certain aspects of presidential power that are still yet to be debated and may also require some level of guardrails, but they also don't want to legitimately limit a president's legitimate powers too greatly. So this is going to be a careful question, but I think they have to ultimately push back on how expansive a definition Trump took.
The no man is above the law was the theme of the Magna Carta. If we want to go back that far, Teddy Roosevelt is quoted as having said it, and I'll check other references, but Teddy Roosevelt was given the big source reference, and then Magna Carta, if you will. Okay, Dan, where do we go from here politically? Should we feel better this week than we did last week? A little bit encouraged, and we need to go.
We should be encouraged that America stepped up to the plate with a world on fire, but the underlying problems in our politics remain.
And Israel is quieting down, and oil prices are coming down, and Iran is backing off. I know I said we were going to go, but just give me one line.
No, look, I think everyone has done their performative tit for tat there, and the red lines have somewhat held, but still hardly stable.
Michael Farr and the Farrcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farrcast and your host, Michael Farr.
We appreciate you listening into the Farrcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, a Farrcast fan favorite and one of my favorites, one of the brightest people we ever get to talk to on the Farrcast or anywhere else. You can see her on CNBC. Liz Young is the head of the investment strategy at SoFi. She is a pro's pro, and I want to tell you, take it off of mute whenever you see Liz Young and just listen, write it down. Remember what she said. That's what you should do. Good morning, Liz. Welcome back.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me.
We're really glad you're here. Markets are pulling back this morning. We've had a negative April after this huge run in all of these stocks that never seemed like it was going to end. We've had actually what the Fed has done, run smack into the market narrative of many more cuts and lower rates, which has just perplexed me from the beginning. I don't get it. I don't know why the Fed can't declare victory and just say, hey, we did it. We got rates to the exact correct point. We've got still low unemployment. We've got inflation trending the right way. We think overall, we have to give it some time. We've got a couple of blips, but maybe we can just leave this thing alone and declare victory, but nobody wants them to do that. What do you think's going on, Liz?
Well, I think largely that's what they've tried to say, and markets haven't listened. And, you know, I mean, markets need something to do on a weekly basis. So they look for reasons.
Okay, best line I've heard in months. As to why markets do what they, because markets need something to do. That's awesome.
Bored. Yeah. I mean, so we're looking for some phrase, some word, some data point that says, oh, okay, we're not priced correctly. Let's reprice this. And look, coming into this correction, we were priced for some really great numbers to come in. We were priced for a strong earnings environment. We were priced for a strong economic environment. We were priced for maybe even a strengthening environment as the year went on. And we were certainly priced for no geopolitical shocks. Yes. So we were at a place where things had to be darn near perfect in order to justify those multiples. And I'm not even just saying that. I know everybody's heard that statement before. But if you look at where the 10-year Treasury was and just the movement in yields in April alone, multiples were really high given what happened in yields and given the move back up and some of these hotter inflation prints. And I think the other thing that happened was, especially with the Fed and what they were talking about, was the inflation prints for January and February did come in hotter than expected. But the message was, that's okay. It's still within our expectations. Right. And then March came in and it was like, whoa, wait, hold on. That's maybe a little bit above what we thought. And then 3 months in a row makes a trend. So now we've got, it was actually 4 months in a row of higher than expected inflation. But there was something about that March print that made the Fed less confident. And those were Jerome Powell's words. They still needed more confidence that inflation was moving towards target. And now they're feeling like maybe they have to wait a little bit longer. So to answer the first question you said at the top of this segment, I think they have been trying to tell the market, so far, so good, no reason to move. There's nothing that's telling us we need to move. So get used to the idea that we're gonna be here for a while longer.
What are you thinking about earnings coming in sort of a ho-hum way? I mean, from what I'm seeing, they're not awful. Right. Wall Street's very sensitive to kind of any miss anywhere, and they're looking very closely at the forward-looking statements. But boy, when I looked at the bank earnings, and not only did I not see further credit write-downs, but actually they were releasing some reserves, adding them back to earnings, and the bank earnings doing so well. That to me, from those folks who are talking to a lot of the most sensitive areas of the economy as borrowers, that was really pretty strong. So tell me about earnings season. I mean, for economically, that tells me I don't see a big crisis. And it tells me that at least if there's a commercial real estate loan crisis on the balance sheets of banks, it's not really rearing its ugly head yet. So we bought time.
Yeah, well, I definitely think we've bought time. And the commercial real estate piece, I mean, it's not to say that it's a small risk. It's still a risk that's out yes. there, largely in the regional banks. But the thing about it is that we know it's a risk. We've known it's a risk for a year, more than a year. So it's not something that would come in and surprise investors at this point. That's not to say that it's entirely priced in. But if suddenly there was a headline that something happened in commercial real estate, it's not as if everybody would look around and say, oh my gosh, I didn't see that coming. So the risks that we know about are not the ones that are likely to come in, pull the rug out from underneath multiples and cause this big contraction. The bank earnings always set the tone for earnings season. So we want to see strength from banks. And I think to your point, we did see a decent amount of strength, or at least durable movement, right? Durable growth, durable results. But this earnings season, Q1 of 2024, was never expected to be a huge growth quarter. Right. We were coming into it expecting somewhere between 0 and 5%. We're still tracking somewhere between 0 and 5%, which is fine. It, you know, positive, but nothing to write home about. And all of this earnings growth that people keep talking about for 2024 is really expected to come from the third and fourth quarter. And yes. we're far from that. So we still have to make it to the third and fourth quarter. So this quarter's earnings season, in my opinion, has been less about whether or not Q1 was good and more about trying to justify that there's growth and stability that can tell us that these multiples make sense. So the guidance and the idea that it was JP Morgan came out and didn't change, I think it's net interest margin, right?
Right.
It didn't go down. These weren't bad results, but they didn't raise margins. They didn't raise their projection as much as the street wanted them to, and then the stock got punished. So I think that's a theme that we're going to see. If guidance doesn't get raised as much as investors want it to, you get punished, even if the results were pretty good.
Net interest margins were a bit of a problem across the board, not so much for JP Morgan, but were a bit of a problem across the board for a lot of the other banks. But okay, you know, and I always look at credit because a credit cycle if you start to see bank reserves adding and problems in credit, that sticks with you a long time. That really does undermine the rest of your markets, and that can undermine, but that didn't happen. So as you're suggesting, we're trying to price in how we survive until things get significantly better, which we're hoping for out of earnings in the fall. There's some certain comments. I think you're presuming some things, two things. One, that the consumer can continue to consume at a mm-hmm. voracious rate or reasonably mm-hmm. voracious rate, that they are not going to run out of wallet. And my concern, I've been surprised. I've been wrong. I thought they would run out of wallet long before now. And yet, talking to one of our consumer analysts at Farmiller in Washington, he says, we are seeing at a couple of the companies he follows, retailers, lower ticker price ticket prices when they look at the receipts, the lower overall receipts rate, and fewer receipts, fewer sales. So from what he's seeing, some early signs of consumers pulling back. Maybe that happens, maybe that doesn't. I'm asking two questions at once here. So there's the first question. My second question, make sure we get to it. I have to do this because I'm older now. And if I don't give them both, you see, I forget the second one. And I think, damn, that was a good question. Why the hell didn't I say? So the second question, I almost did it again. At 20 times earnings, I'm also hearing from analysts when they were talking to me about stocks and other things and saying, Michael, it's 20 times earnings. The overall industry group's at 22 times earnings. So it's a 10% discount to the industry group. And therefore, we think it's attractive on this basis. Long, and I'm thinking it's 20 times earnings. Now, I got it. I'm an old guy at this, but it's not 15 times earnings. You show me 15 times earnings, and I'll go, oh, it's 15 times earnings, really, and it's growing earnings, and they've got really a sustainable story. That's good. It's hard to convince me because mm-hmm. of my long-term experience doing this, that I should get excited about anything selling at 20 times earnings, more or less 32 times earnings with the Magnificent Seven, a lot of them. What do you, both sure. Will?
So I'll take, I'm a little younger. I'll try to remember both questions.
You're a lot younger.
And answer them. But so I do that too. I'm like, where was I going with this again? I know I had another point. So the first question is the consumer pulling back. Yes, I think they are pulling back. So far, not in a painful way for retailers, but we're starting to hear things about trading down again, and that's really just inflation driven, because I think consumers have gotten now used to the idea that every time I go to the grocery store, eggs are going to be too expensive, and my bill for just the necessities is a lot higher than it used to be. So I think what it's doing at this point, and I'm painting with a broad brush here, there is a lower income consumer that is really feeling the pinch and has been for a long time. If we're talking about middle income to upper income, you start to realize that, okay, wait, these bills are higher than I wanted them to be. So there's less of a buffer if something else goes wrong. For example, the grocery bill, the food at home, or the food out bill is higher than it used to be. Now, if gas prices go up, I'm going to have to make some changes in order to not spend too much. So there's less of a buffer for, I won't call it catastrophe, but less of a buffer for other things to move around. Also, we all know about the credit card balances and the slow tick up in delinquencies that's happening. None of that is alarming yet, but I think it does prove that consumers at some level had run out of that excess cash and started to spend on credit in order to maintain their spending habits. So there's been this desire to spend, and Guy Adami says this all the time, never underestimate the consumer's desire to spend. So they want to keep doing it, and they're going to try to do that in any way that they can. In a healthy economy, credit that drives spending is a good thing. So it's not always a bad thing that credit card debt goes up or that there's more leverage in the economy that's allowing people to spend. When it becomes a problem is if rates are rising at the same time, and then people have to somehow maintain and cover that debt. And it becomes a problem if wages aren't keeping up with the spending. So far, we're managing to walk that tightrope. And it's possible that we don't end up in some kind of catastrophic situation just because of consumer spending. And I think that's actually the key to this, is that so many people have been, self-included, have been watching the consumer and saying, well, if the consumer slows down, then we're really in trouble. So we're looking at it as the only real risk out there is consumer spending. Well, now we're finding out that, oh, wait, there's a lot of geopolitical tension going on in the world that could completely change the game for months at a time. And we have to be careful about that. So
what do you think about 20 times earnings, Liz? What do you think about 20 times earnings?
20 times, well, so in defense of people that would say, well, it's below 22 times earnings of the peer group or the industry group, you can't put it all in the same basket. Some things are going to be more expensive naturally just because of the nature of what the stock is. So something that is expected to produce really strong growth in the future, you probably should pay up for that. If we're talking about the index on a whole, so somewhere between 20 and 21 times earnings, we're trading in about the 75th percentile of forward PE for a long time.
Yes.
And now you could say, well, it's not the 99th percentile, so it's not extremely overvalued, but the 75th percentile is up there, which is to my earlier point that we're priced for a pretty good environment here. And any disappointments or any shocks do put the market at risk for a pullback or maybe a repricing. And then yields, especially, the last time that the 10-year yield hit 5%, the S&P was at 4,200. So if that needs to be where we are, there's a lot of room on the downside there in order to right size valuations. So I think the troubling part for investors right now is asking themselves the question, do I already hold it or am I trying to enter it? If you already hold stuff that has run up in price and that looks overvalued, there's not necessarily something telling you that says, I got to get out now because everything's headed down. So you could hold it and wait out some of these question marks, wait out earnings season and find out what happens. If you're looking for an entry point, those are harder to find at these levels. So then you have to get choosy about it. And then you might even have to take more risk. If you're looking for an entry point broadly, small caps look pretty attractive. However, they're also most at risk of rising rates. And we've seen them take it on the chin through April. So that's not a place that I'd be entering based purely on valuations. If you're looking at the equity market, I still think that we are in an elongated part of late cycle. So then what do you want in that part of the cycle? You want dividend payers, you want large cap stocks, you want probably things like utilities, you want energy here, and you want to be careful to not spread yourself across a lot of the stocks that have run up so much in the rally that started in October.
Absolutely brilliant. Perfect place to end. Liz Young, head of investment strategy at SoFi. And I'm telling you, if you don't agree with me now, you weren't listening. This is one of the smartest people on Wall Street in the investment community. Listen to Liz. I'm going to have t-shirts made. Listen to Liz. Liz Young, thank you so much for being with us on the Farcast.
Thanks, Michael.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. We bring you insiders from across Wall Street, from across Washington, and across the world to help us better understand what's going on in the economy, the world of politics, everything else, so that you can make better decisions and you can think more critically. We hope it's helped again this week. I'll be back again next week. From Harry Jennings, our producer, everybody at Farr, Miller & Washington, Hightower Advisors, thanks so much for listening. Please share us on your social media. I'm Michael Farr. See you next week.
That's a wrap on this episode of the Farcast. Thanks for being with us this week, and thanks to our guest, Kenny Polcari, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest from SoFi, Liz Young. Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and TuneIn. You can stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new one. Please be aware that anytime we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, news headline, or economic trend, it is not a recommendation to buy or sell. Review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. As always, if we can be of assistance at Farr, Miller & Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'm happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. Please subscribe and share the show, and we'll be back with you next week. Our schedule in coming weeks includes Dr. Jay Bryson, Chief Economist from Wells Fargo. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world.
Farr Miller & Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties expressed or implied as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability or any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.